they don't believe that the results were fair is banned? That's the thinking, because it'll result in riots. Yeah. You realize what a gigantic lie that we're living through? You're not allowed to say you don't believe the last election results. Why can't you say that? Why could you say for 3 years you believed Russian collusion with the Trump campaign? Why were those people allowed to have their Twitter account? Why are people who say that men give birth allowed to keep a Twitter account? Oh, man. Do they not make a mockery of reality? I know it's the opposite. Yes, if you say men can't give birth, right? Or probably get thrown off. No, I don't. He asked if I want to go to a live briefing on climate change from the White House. And I said, no, I don't. I'm sorry. He's speaking from a podium wearing a mask? You're kidding me. Who is?
Gina McCarthy. Who's a true radical.
So this executive order establishes a White House Office of Domestic Climate Policy, and it directs everyone...
Why is she speaking with a mask? Is anybody 6 feet from her?
At our Who is that? To solve the climate
Sorry?
Crisis. Because we're going
Gina to McCarthy? She's in charge of the climate issue. They're drama queens. The left is drama queens. If there isn't turmoil, they don't breathe. Talk about asphyxiation. The left is asphyxiated when there is no turmoil. Things on planet Earth, outside of evil regimes like North Korea and Iran and so on, things have been getting better and better. More people employed, more people eating, more people out of poverty, more travel, more interaction between nations. But for the left, normal causes what it causes your aunt or uncle who is a drama queen or a drama king. They can't handle it. There's always has to be an existential crisis. There has been my entire life. There's always an existential crisis, and it's always created by the left. Because it's that they thrive on it because they're soulless, and they have to fill their soul. What makes a drama queen a drama queen? It's not knowable. It's their nature. It's their air. The existential crisis. And it is a way to move the country toward a communist way of thinking. We have to control more and more of your life because you're killing the planet, or because of the systemic racism. This is what kids believe this. Okay, so more from the president's talk on racial equity. He praised America's youth, forcing us to confront systemic racism and white supremacy. It's just been weeks since all of America witnessed a group of thugs, insurrectionists, political extremists, and white supremacists violently attack the capital of our democracy. An entire summer, all over the country, of thugs. Did one Democrat call them thugs? Is there a left-wing thug, President Biden? Is there? White supremacists? Do you know that they were white supremacists who went into the Capitol? Did you know that? I thought they were there because they were angry about the vote. Why are they white supremacists? Anybody who supports the president, former president? I'm going to read you more. This is how they defend the suppression of free speech in this country. Hello, everybody. Dennis Prager here. Ryan in Atlanta, Georgia. Hello.
Hi, Dennis. So I was just, first of all, I do love your show. Very good show.
Thank you.
I listen to it daily.
Thank you.
But my question is, going back to what you were saying about George Floyd, are you saying that he didn't die from the officer's knee being on his neck?
Apparently, like, according there were two autopsy reports, and one says he didn't, mm-hmm. and one says he did.
I haven't heard of the two autopsy reports. I've only heard of one that said that he died from suffocation.
Right. Well, let me say, I have zero vested interest except truth. I've been broadcasting 35 years. I am Absolutely. Committed to the truth more than any other single thing. It does not appear mm-hmm. that common use of a way of subduing a suspect who won't enter the police car, this commonly used tactic, has ever killed anybody. It might have. I don't know. It'll be interesting to see what the jury recommends, but I don't believe the Minneapolis Police Department would have something that is likely to kill somebody.
Okay. I'm not going to say that it didn't kill them.
I'm not going to say it didn't either. I don't know. I said, Absolutely. Look, I said, because I'm committed to telling you the truth, people were saying he can't breathe, he can't breathe. And that is a charge against the policeman, but it is also a charge against the charge that he was killed, which is the mainstream press's charge. I don't know if he was killed by the policeman, and I don't know if he was killed by the policeman that it was racist. These are two huge leaps that the country has taken, causing untold anger and damage. Okay.
I absolutely believe that. I can agree with the fact that the media has definitely turned America into something that I don't think it's been in quite some time. I think it's been elevated. Of course, social media has completely reformed the entire world and the way that we operate.
That's right.
I will say, with regards to this police brutality that everyone's talking about, and more specifically with George Floyd's scenario, since that's what you're talking about this morning or this afternoon, I do think that looking at that video, that there should be some type of reform done to the police department. Police department shouldn't hurt people, shouldn't kill people. That's not their goal. Their goal is to protect.
I am with you. You're a good man. I'm honored to have you as a listener. I just want to say, I don't know. I admit, I don't know if this thing has ever killed anybody. I would allow myself, let me put it to you this way. I would allow myself to have a knee on the side of my neck and see what happens. That is how skeptical I am that is a direct killer of human beings. It's hard for me to believe the Minneapolis Police Department would have something routine that has a likelihood of killing. Okay. Anyway, I'm going to continue with thank you again, and I'm going to continue with Professor Hilarious. PR is president, PR is professor. This is such a wonderful country, and it's painted as so dark, including by President Biden. This phony crap about his being a uniter, it's so, the lying media, which is redundant, go along with this. I read to you his speech, his disgusting speech, that the 1776 is a lie. That he said that. He said that in his speech. Counterfactual. Sorry, counterfactual, yeah. President Trump set up a commission to try to counter with facts the spectacular lie of the New York Times that the country was founded in 1619 when the first slaves arrived, and that we fought the American Revolution in order to preserve slavery. Liberal, Trump-hating historians, the leading historians of America, called it a lie, starting with Sean Wilentz at Princeton. And this president, this phony, has the audacity to say it's counterfactual. He'll say anything that the left wants him to say. It's like a marionette standing up there. This guy who's made a fortune while being in politics. How did he make a fortune? Trump made a fortune as a private citizen. Joe Biden's been a politician his entire life. I wish I didn't have to say this. I don't enjoy attacking a president. The left loves it, but I do not enjoy it. Wow. Counterfactual. San Francisco board votes to strip names of Lincoln and Washington from local schools. This is the headline in The Hill. What do you think of that, huh? You don't think the left is out to destroy this country? Washington and Lincoln are so bad you can't keep them on school names? Do you understand? What does it take to convince you the left loathes this country and wants to destroy it as we have known it? What evidence do you need? I give it to you every day. I don't know what animates them. I don't really give a damn. School board in San Francisco has voted to do away with the names of dozens of schools in the district that some have deemed hold offensive histories. Among the schools set to have their names changed are Lowell High School, Lincoln High, Washington High, Roosevelt Middle. Roosevelt. I assume it's Theodore Roosevelt. John Muir Elementary. What's wrong with John Muir? The environmentalist.
Yeah, there was something about him.
I remember. He came out for the protection of white trees. Yeah, that's right. I think that was it. I think that was the issue. Feinstein Elementary School. What's wrong with Dianne Feinstein? She's like one of the leading liberals of the last half century. Isn't that amazing? They called him a racist. They made derogatory comments about black and indigenous people. Well, Feinstein Elementary is named after Senator Dianne Feinstein. Democrat, California, is among the longest serving members of the upper chamber. It's a message to our families, our students, and our community, said board member Mark Sanchez. According to the San Francisco Chronicle, it's not just symbolic, it's a moral message. So Mark Sanchez is morally superior to Abraham Lincoln. What a great man. What a great arrogant SOB. Wow. Well, it's a product of our college system. Lincoln's name was recommended for a removal from one of the city's high schools due to the reported treatment of Native Americans. Oh. Some community members voiced opposition to the move. I must admit there are reasons to support this resolution, but I can't, local resident John Parrish told the newspaper. These are not decisions that should be made in haste. I assure you they were not made in haste, sir. The left has been desiring to destroy this country for half a century. Debate over the names of schools in San Francisco has been going on for some time. In December, a committee's recommendation to rename many of the schools drew some backlash, including from former President Trump, who at the time called it so ridiculous and unfair. I missed that. Many of his tweets were over the top and very injurious to him. But as I said the entire time, everybody's a package, and he did so much good. I had no choice but to tolerate the tweets. London Breed, the city's African-American mayor. Did you know that? That the mayor of San Francisco was named London Breed? Is it a male or a female? Have you ever heard of a person named London? I knew someone named Newark, but I never knew anybody named London. Person. Yeah, person. Yeah, person. Remember that guy, Newark Cohen? He's a member of the synagogue. He's a Torah reader. And now we call on Newark to read this week's portion. Why do you give a child? I'm not being cute. This is obviously not against this person. He didn't give himself or she didn't give her. Is it a male or female? Please tell me, because I'd like to know he or she. But why would a parent name a child London? It is a female? Okay. What do you mean appears to be a female? Oh, okay. So that's what you're being. You don't know that that's the chosen pronoun. So based on that, you have already assigned her a sex. Anyway, London, all right, so yes, female. London Breed, the city's African-American mayor, has previously voiced opposition to renaming the schools, saying the board should instead focus on reopening their buildings to students and dealing with the coronavirus pandemic. Exactly what you said into my earphones. It's offensive to me as someone who went to our public schools, who loves our public schools, and who knows how those years in the classroom are what lifted me out of poverty and into college, Breed said last fall. It's offensive to our kids who are staring at screens day after day instead of learning and growing with their classmates and friends. Did I ever think I would agree with the mayor on San Francisco about anything? She's right. It's not offensive, it's criminal. The teachers' unions are a disgrace to children. The greatest harm to children being done in the United States of America today is being done by teachers because of their unions and because they go along with the unions. That's a fact. Spoke to you about the Chicago teachers' union the other day. CDC had another report about how rare it is to have a child-to-teacher transmission of COVID. And even then, your chances of being seriously hurt or killed are minuscule. Combination of cowardice and left-wing politics. Bad combination. He is the president. I don't deny that. But he has already done spectacular damage to my beloved country. I now continue with his remarks at signing from the White House an executive order on racial equity. One of the reasons I'm so optimistic about this nation is that today's generation of young Americans is the most progressive, thoughtful, inclusive generation that America has ever seen. Well, thoughtful, that's a toughie. And they are pulling us toward justice in so many ways, forcing us to confront the huge gap in economic inequity, I'm reading as it's written, between those at the top and everyone else, forcing us to confront the existential crisis of climate, and yes, forcing us to confront systemic racism and white supremacy. Almost every talk he uses the words white supremacy. This is a gigantic lie of the left, that white supremacy is a danger in this country. Do any of you know a white supremacist? I mean, other than Sean, I don't know one. Just the other day, he walked in, he goes, "Whites are supreme." He was talking about egg whites, but it doesn't matter. His very preference for egg whites is suspect. There's no question. And now, as I return to Earth, do any of you know a white supremacist? Is there anyone? Let me explain white supremacy. Why it's almost impossible to be a white supremacist if you give it any thought. So let's say in my case, now I have not been charged with white supremacy, I will admit. Bigotry, yes. Sexist, intolerant, xenophobic, homophobic, racist, bigoted, yeah. But I'm not white supremacist. But let's say I were. So here's one clear reason why it would be unlikely. Were the Nazis white? Yes. So how can you be a white supremacist Now, you could say, well, you could be Nazi. Okay, but I'm a Jew, so they wouldn't have allowed me in the club. B, I would have been dead. But other than that, it's powerful rhetoric. But how about this? What color were the communists in Europe? What color was Stalin? What color was Lenin? What color was Trotsky? What color were all the communist leaders of Eastern Europe? White. They were all white. So the notion of white supremacy is a self-contradictory notion, because there are gigantic numbers of whites who have done evil to whites. Who do you think Stalin sent to the gulag? Blacks? White supremacist. For the president of the United States to regularly talk about white supremacy means he lies in a much more serious manner than his predecessor. See, they want it both ways. Oh, we would never cheat. But the man is pure evil. Well, if he's pure evil, then you should cheat. That's my question. And that's the reason I'm agnostic. See, with all the anomalies of this last election, I would still say, yeah, okay, there are all these anomalies. The first president, sitting president, to get more votes than he had the first time he ran and still lose in 132 years or whatever it was. I have the number in the article. Yeah, the 19 bellwether counties, Trump won 18 of them. All right, it's an anomaly. Trump won the bellwether states of, was it Florida, Ohio, and what's the other one? Iowa and North Carolina. Anomaly. I would live with that. But you have to believe that Democrats wouldn't cheat if they could. Why would I believe that? They're saving the country if they cheat. See? So either they were lying about how evil he is, or they cheated. Let's go to Russ in Covina, California. Hello, Russ.
Hi, Dennis. How are you?
Okay, thank you.
Good, thank you. First of all, thank you so much for everything that you do.
Oh, that's sweet of you. You're welcome.
The list is too long to mention for your time. I think you're wrong about your point about people would naturally cheat if they thought a tyrant was up for election.
Right.
Your logic is good as logic goes, but the issue isn't logic; it's a moral code.
Right. It's a moral code. I agree.
Clear. Leftists do not have any moral code whatsoever. I mean, that's really clear. It's ideology, and they are true believers.
Okay, so if they have no moral code, no matter what the answer is, they cheated. You see, if they had no moral code, then they would cheat, and if they had a moral code, they would cheat. Because if you have a moral code and you're stopping a fascist, you should cheat.
No. Conservatives don't think that way.
I do. If I could have stopped Hitler in 1932 and I was a vote counter in Germany, I would have cheated.
You do other things, not you wouldn't.
I don't agree with you.
You wouldn't mess with your moral code.
Well, it messes with my legal code, but it doesn't mess with my moral code. Keeping a monster out of office and saving millions of lives is in keeping with my morality.
Well, I understand where you're coming from, because you and I think so much alike about the left, and I'm so grateful that you say what you say and how you say it.
Well, thank you. All right, look, I'm very glad that Russ called. I people need to think this through. If the Democrats counting votes don't have a strong moral code, then they cheated. If the Democrats counting votes have a strong moral code, they cheated. That's my challenge. I have a strong moral code. I would cheat to prevent a Nazi from taking over in America. And anyone who wouldn't is mistaken morally, in my opinion. All right? That's the challenge. See, I don't know if they have been... the only question I don't know the answer to is, do they believe their lies about Trump being a white supremacist? I can't know that. I think if you say anything enough, you start to believe it. So if you believe it and they have a moral code, this is the problem. It's never raised. That's probably why Real Clear Politics took the piece immediately. This point is never raised. If Democrats are wonderful moral people, they cheated. If Democrats are crooked, they cheated. Question is, did they cheat enough to change the results of the national election? I don't know that. That's the part I'm agnostic about. But I have no agnosticism with regard to whether they cheated. If they're good, they cheated. And if they're bad, they cheated. Looking for a refutation of my logic. Dennis Prager Show every Tuesday about some great issue of life. And if the recent past has not made you keenly aware of how important it is to work out some of the great issues of life, I guess nothing will. So, on a number of occasions... Mostly not, but on a number of occasions, I have a guest for the Ultimate Issues Hour, and I have a risky topic. Yes, indeed. Riskier than sex. The topic is death. That's the riskiest topic you could address. People don't want to think about it. Ever since Ernest Becker's book, The Denial of Death, many years ago, where he made the case that that's what people work hardest at. Denying death. But it's a fact of life, and it is best to address it. And the book is The Beauty of What Remains, and it is a Rabbi Steve Leader. Is it Steve? I know you as Steve, so forgive me. Is it Leader or
Steve
Letter?
Steve works just fine.
Thank you. Leader or
Steve,
Letter?
Steve works just fine.
I know
you as Dennis.
That's correct.
Leader.
Okay, good.
Yeah.
Well, I've had you on before. You were a very popular guest. The book, again, is The Beauty of What Remains. I was actually pleasantly surprised to see at how well it is doing on Amazon. People, everybody knows either, they know, everybody knows they'll die. Everybody knows that loved ones will die. I mean, that is the what is it? Only death and taxes are inevitable. So you would think that more would be done. I was reading your book, and it was fascinating to me that you wrote the most popular High Holy Day service sermon you ever gave was the one on death.
Yeah, that's correct. You know, it was 3 years ago. And in a way, the book is, to some degree, an apology for that sermon. So let me explain. I gave that sermon about 3 years ago. Many of your listeners would not know this, but the holiest night of the year for Jews is constructed, and as is the following day, is constructed in many ways to force us to think about our deaths. It's almost like a Jewish day for the dead. For example, we wear white to mimic the burial shroud that traditional Jews are buried in. We fast because the dead neither eat nor drink. We begin the service by taking three of our sacred scrolls out and holding them in front of the congregation. Those three scrolls represent the heavenly tribunal that legend has it we will stand before after we die. And they're standing in front of the empty ark that holds those sacred scrolls, and the Hebrew word for ark is the same as the word for coffin. So imagine the imagery for people who realize what they're looking at. You're standing before these three symbolic judges in front of your open casket, dressed in a burial shroud-like garment, and it is all meant to force us to think about our death so that we will change our lives for the better. Death, in my opinion, and this is after 33-plus years of being up close with it, with 1,000 or more families, to me, death is really the ultimate teacher of how and why we should lead more meaningful and more beautiful lives. Now, what happened with that sermon is I wrote it and delivered it that evening, and then 1 year later to the day, Dennis, the morning before Kol Nidre, 1 year after that sermon, I buried my father in Minnesota. And that was after a 10-year journey with him through Alzheimer's. And then I was really encountering my own very personal loss and grief. In essence, the book also explores this tension between Steve Leader the rabbi and Steve Leader the son, which was a dichotomous tension that was sometimes very difficult for me. And so I wrote the book, in a sense, as I say in the prologue, to bring... I realized after my dad died that that sermon was just 1 degree shy of the deepest truth that death comes to teach us about life. And so I wrote this book to carry us all down to that 1% deeper level of understanding of what death comes to teach us. Because my father's death caused me to rethink 30 years of experience and teaching for others.
Are you personally, are you frightened of dying?
I am now, but only because that means I'm not dying. This is a very helpful counterintuitive point to people who are anxious about death. And this is one of the points that every interviewer, without exception, has hit on after reading the book. In the book, I talk about the fact that I've been, and this is not rabbinic hyperbole, I've been next to the bedside of at least 1,000 dying people. And I ask, and by dying, I mean actively dying, you know, hours or a day away from death. And I ask, are you afraid? And every time the answer is no. Now, the dying have some fear for the living. Are the kids going to be okay? Are they going to take care of mom? Are they going to stay together? But for themselves, the dying, when they are actually dying, are entirely fearless. Because at a certain point, more is not better. At a certain point, you have been weaned and prepared by a disease. And at a certain point, death feels like the most natural thing in the world to embrace. The closest thing I can come to explaining it, having seen it so often, is to me, it's a little bit like having the worst jet lag you have ever had in your life, where you are just zombie-like. And all you want to do is crawl into bed, pull the covers up, snuggle in, and go to sleep. You're not afraid to go to sleep. You're not anxious. You're not depressed. It's what you want to do. And that's the closest helpful example I can give. And as I said earlier, the counterintuitive beauty of this is when people come to me and say, Rabbi, I'm so afraid of death. I say, well, the fact that you're afraid is proof today is not your day. Anxiety is for the living. You're fine. You know, it's not your day. Of course, there are outliers. People do get hit by buses and in car accidents and have massive strokes or sudden heart attacks. But generally speaking, when death comes, it comes as a friend.
Now, I take it, I feel funny asking this because you're a rabbi, but in the world in which we live, not all rabbis believe in God. Do you believe in God?
Absolutely.
Does that help you confront death?
It helps me confront everything because I'm able to ask myself, have I done the godly thing? Have I done what I believe God would require of me? And it does help. And I do believe in a sort of afterlife. You know, the problem with anyone's afterlife belief is there's only one way to find out if you're right, and you can't really come back to talk about it. So we can only guess at these things. In my case, after seeing so many dead bodies, it's abundantly clear, I think to any of us who've seen a dead body, that that is not the person we knew and loved. That is an empty vessel. There is so much more to us than our corporeal beings. We all have that other component that made us who we are. You can call it a soul, you can call it a spirit, you can call it an essence, you can call it energy. I don't really care, you know, what your psycholinguistic preference is. But we all, when we see a dead body, recognize that that's not really the person we knew and loved. And I don't believe that soul, as it, I call it a soul, dies with the body. I just don't believe it. Where it goes, I don't know. You know, where was it before we were born? I don't know. But there is a realm where I believe it exists.
And, the book is The Beauty of What Remains, Rabbi Steve Leder, 1-8-PRAGER-776. My guest is Doctor, that's funny. You know, I'll tell the rabbi what that reminds me of, is Rabbi Steve Leder. Do you know what it reminds me? And I was going to say doctor. I don't know if you heard, I'm sure you did, but in case you didn't, there's a great line of Milton Himmelfarb, a great Jewish thinker of the last generation. When rabbis became doctors, Jews got sick.
Yes, yes, yes. The famous line. Yeah. That's right.
Yeah, it's really great.
Yeah, or Judaism got sick.
Yeah, right. One of the two. That's right. I don't remember. Yeah. Good point.
Yeah.
Rabbi Leder, rabbi of the Wilshire Boulevard Temple in Los Angeles, is the author of The Beauty of What Remains, and it's his reflections on death. And having been with, by his estimate, 1,000 dying people, not to mention how many funerals, etc.
Yes.
Why, this is a bit, it's completely related, but it is obviously not the subject of your book, but related. Why do so many Jews not believe in the afterlife?
Well, Judaism, particularly the first wave of Jews to America, were heavily influenced by the Enlightenment and pragmatism and rationalism. And the whole imagination of the Talmud when it comes to the afterlife is pretty non or even anti-rational. You know, people being resurrected, bones coming up, taking on flesh, rolling in tunnels under the earth to Israel to live in a utopian afterlife that's kind of like studying in a great, you know, academy. It just rubbed up too hard against the ideals and values of the Enlightenment that swept across Europe after Napoleon liberated the Jews. And I think that it just was too non-rational or anti-rational, and so it got, you know, tucked in a drawer for all but the Orthodox community, and we started to embrace other ideas, which are, you know, less specific and therefore easier to embrace if you're a rationalist. I really think it's that simple. But I'll tell you, ask any rabbi who has dealt with any significant number of families who are grieving, and that rabbi will have heard far too many stories about things like, you know, butterflies showing up on his birthday every year, or a certain song playing the moment you were thinking about her, or, you know, a memory from a smell or a breeze or a dream, you know. And we've all heard these stories, and I can tell you I've heard far too many to dismiss them as sheer coincidence or nonsense. I just don't see it that way. And in another way, you know, The book is a dual narrative. It's a field guide for grief and loss and mourning, but it's also my story of my journey with my father through Alzheimer's and his death and his afterlife. I feel and encounter my father every single day. He still makes me laugh. He still warns me about a potential mistake. He still humbles me when I, you know, get too haughty. And he still comforts me. And he still annoys me. So, you know, now maybe this is just, people would say, an afterlife of memory. I say, so what? It works. And I appreciate it. This is part of the reason I called the book The Beauty of What Remains. Because my relationship with my father is in many ways more beautiful now than it was when he was alive. And that's a gift.
Do you ever tell parents who've lost a child that they will see them again?
I don't, because I can't say that with certainty. And people who have lost a child are in such a searingly vulnerable emotional state that I would never want to present something to them that I wasn't absolutely certain of. And I would say that you're going to experience him and feel him for the rest of your lives. You know, I've dealt, unfortunately, with many, many families who have had to bury a child. And, you know, it's sort of like a phantom limb. It's an amputation, but you still feel the limb there, always, you know, for the rest of your life. And this leads to a nuanced point I make in the book about memory. This is one of the things from the sermon, Dennis, that I had to change as a result of losing my father. You know, we have all these platitudes about memory. May his memory be a blessing. She'll live on in memory. Thank God we have memories. And that's all true. But there's a duality to memory that we don't fully embrace. And that duality is that, yes, memory is beautiful. And it really, really hurts. You know, in the book I say it's like being caressed and spat on at the same time. That's memory. And that's what we somehow have to find a way to make peace with. Just like we have to find a way to make peace with the cognitive dissonance we feel toward our parents in life and in death, right? We all have this tension in us between things that we're grateful for and that sting us. And that's so intensely true for the death of a child. And I'll tell you another thing that I learned because of my father's death and my grief. I used to say to parents, sitting in the chapel before the service began to bury their child, I would look them in the eye and I would say, Dennis, the most honest and helpful thing I can say to you right now is it won't always hurt so much. Then my father died, and I don't say that anymore. What I say now is, Dennis, the most honest and helpful thing I can say to you right now is it won't always hurt so often.
All right, we'll continue. I have my own set of questions. Rabbi Steve Leader, book is up at DennisPrager.com.
Hello, Dennis. How are you doing?
Okay.
I just want to ask you if you're agnostic as to whether Republicans cheated in the election.
No, I'm not, because we don't have nearly as many examples of Republicans cheating in elections as Democrats, going back to Kennedy Nixon. And where would they have cheated? Since they lost, where would they have cheated?
I don't think there's any widespread fraud going on. I think that's all just...
No, it's irrelevant what you think. It's irrelevant what I think. You have to answer my question. If you believe you could stop a neo-Nazi from being president, would you cheat? I'm asking you. I would. Would you?
I would, too. I'm just asking.
Okay, so the Democrats believe that he's a neo-Nazi. So why wouldn't they cheat?
Some do. You believe the left destroys everything they touch?
Yes.
They hate America?
Yes.
Yes? A lot of Republicans believe Democrats are running a satanic pedophile ring.
I don't. You don't know what you're talking about. You've been listening to CNN too long. I work in Republican circles. I have never met anybody who thinks that the Democrats are running a satanic pedophile ring. You read lies and then you believe them.
No, I read people's actual. I hear people's actual comments.
Oh, really? Who has said that? Who has any? Who has a responsible position as a conservative or Republican and said that?
Well, who says which prominent person called Trump a neo-Nazi?
Oh, what? You're kidding me, right? He is called that in the New York Times regularly. He's a white supremacist. You're kidding me, right? You don't know if Democrats have called him a white supremacist and a fascist?
Oh, yeah. I didn't say, but neo-Nazi, whatever.
Okay, so fine. All right, so we'll stick to fascist. I'm sorry? Well, Charlottesville, he said, yeah, the Charlottesville. He said that Nazis were fine people. That's what the left tells us.
He didn't name
them. Every left-wing newspaper from the New York Times to the Washington Post said that he said that Nazis are fine people.
He said on both sides, and then he.
That's right, and there were Nazis on one of the sides.
I'm saying, don't you think your characterization of the left, Republicans' characterization, is as hyperbolic and emotional as some that call Trump a Nazi?
No, I don't think so. I think mine is completely accurate. Everything the left has ever touched, it has destroyed. And America is the next victim.
And you wouldn't stop that if you could cheat?
That's correct.
Stop it by cheating?
No, I wouldn't stop that. Because then I would have to cheat in every single race. If I believed one individual were a Nazi or a white supremacist, I would cheat. But you'd have to then cheat in every single election that involves a Democrat. And if we can't win, I believe if we can't win fairly, we have lost the country. I would not cheat. And it would be irrelevant in any case. Because if it isn't Biden, then it's Harris. And if it isn't Harris, then it's Schumer. And if it isn't Schumer, then it's Schiff. It's irrelevant. The argument of the Democrats was that this one man is the embodiment of evil. There is no embodiment of evil on the left. The left is the embodiment of evil. So it's useless. It's not even worthwhile to cheat. There's nobody to cheat against. They just put up another Democrat. You to just think gloom. And I don't want to think just gloom. So it's a tear to understand the gravity of a situation and yet retain one's joie de vivre, a joy of life. My argument in this regard is one that you will, I don't know if I've ever actually stated, but it does play a role in my life. And that is, I don't want to give the bad guys the joy of getting me down. It's a very serious consideration in my life. Then they really win. That's their whole strategy. I'm sorry? That's their whole strategy, said the living martyr. Exactly. Depress us, have us give up, have us just, you know, slink home, and so on. That is exactly right. The left finds our love of life very depressing. Tell me, what does the left enjoy other than power? Can you name anything? I'll give you some time. I'll have some of my delicious homemade iced coffee. My wife and I were talking about this. It is a very interesting gap between them and us. And I've often realized this. It's very hard to understand people who do the opposite of you, and it's an irrational thing. I don't understand people who ache to have power over me. or over you. I don't. I have no desire to have power over anybody. The only people I guess I've ever wanted power over was when my kids were young. And then a parent should have power over their children, because the children get very frazzled if the parent is not in charge. If they feel the parent is not in charge. And God knows I was a pretty easygoing parent. But still, it was important for them, for me, to be the authority. But beyond that, I don't want it over anybody. So it's a gap. And this is the problem. People who don't want to rob banks don't understand people who do want to rob banks, although that's not a perfect analogy, because in a certain sense, I would say that wanting to rob a bank is more natural or more ubiquitous than wanting to have power over other people. I mean, everybody has had to learn to be honest. Robbing a bank is just a picturesque phrase for what I'm talking about, being dishonest. People have to fight to be honest. Some have to fight more than others, but still, almost everybody does. It's natural. Most of the kids in my class cheated on tests, for example. So we don't understand the people who want power over us. We who want to be left alone to enjoy life don't understand the people who want to have power over us. And the problem is that when you don't understand people, you don't imagine that's what is happening. That's the naivete of the liberal. Conservatives understand what's going on. Liberals don't. Liberals, if liberals understood what was going on, the country would be in superb condition, because there are more liberals than leftists. But they don't. So I welcome you to the program. My column, what is today? Tuesday? Yeah, so today's my column day. And I'm happy to say it was picked up by Real Clear Politics. The reason I'm happy about that is because then you're assured that you will have non-conservative readers. Real Clear Politics is completely down the middle. It only takes what it considers the most important left and right articles on any given day. So I have a question that I pose in my column today, and boy, do I wish you would send it out to your liberal relatives. It's asked in a very, very honest way, actually. And I posed this on the radio, where I work through a lot of my theories, because I get your reactions. And I have to articulate it, and then I have to write it, and it's a very good and powerful combination, having to say something and having to write something. There is a member of my synagogue who came from Russia, he and his wife, Soviet Union. Two of the most wonderful people I've ever known. Living Martyr knows them too. And he is watching with incredulity that the sweet land of liberty that he fled to is becoming like the country he fled. He's probably thinking he'll wake up and it will all have been a dream. And I wish that too. I would like this to have been a dream. You understand, the left does not want normal life. Normal life is not exciting to them. This is a crazed man, a crackpot, writing in the New York Times that I read to you. There you go. Putting a column that I can't stand up at the website. You can enjoy it yourself. How terrible things are. And so we cannot go back to the new, what was it? Fossil fueled capitalism. So notice this. What was the capitalism part? You mean we won't have green-fueled, green-energized capitalism? See, that's what David Horowitz said in the beginning. The environmentalists are watermelons, green on the outside, red on the inside. I have a riddle which I've told you a number of times. I made it up. What do you call a religious person who says the world is coming to an end? A crackpot. What do you call a secular person who says the world is coming to an end? An environmentalist. As the pandemic has worn on, the desire to get back to normal has increased, and I worry, says this man I'm reading from, that the hope for radical positive change has subsided. But we must not let it dissipate. We can't afford to, because we won't see normal again in our lifetime. Our parents and grandparents burned normal up in their American-built cars, with their American lifestyles, their American refrigerators, and American dreams. Ah, yes, how disgusting. Middle-class life is the nightmare of the left. People driving to work, having a picket fence around their own home instead of an apartment in downtown urban areas, having two refrigerators perhaps, two-car garage, going to a Rotary Club meeting. This actually has a viscerally negative impact on a leftist. That is a nightmare. It is so unexciting. That's the problem. It's not exciting. Saving the world is exciting. Capitalist normal. Oh my God, it's the worst. Their American lifestyles, their American refrigerators, and American dreams. And now China and India are doing it too, because capitalism is global. And we sold it wherever we could. More than three quarters. Okay, then the CO2 emissions figures. That's right. No more normal, folks. God, I feel bad for kids today. Nothing's normal. Men give birth. That's normal. Right? Drag Queen Study Hour. That's normal. America was founded in 1619, not 1776. That's normal. Refrigerators and cars. That's this American dream crap. But vote for us. Vote for us. We will upend life because, as you know, capitalism is terrible. And since you're so ignorant because you went to an American school, public or private, you have no idea what socialism and communism have wrought in this world. You have no idea. What percentage of Harvard juniors can identify Pol Pot? And you say, oh, come on, give me Pol Pot. Everybody knew who Pol Pot was when he murdered a quarter of his own people in the 70s. Pretty big news. I'm not sure that many could identify Stalin. They might be able to say a Russian leader. How many people did Mao kill? He wouldn't have a clue. Didn't know he killed anybody. Reading a book on the Vietnam War, a gigantic book that came out, Max Hastings, seems very fair, because he acknowledges the evils of communism in Vietnam. Ho Chi Minh got to power the same way Mao did, through terrorizing the peasantry. You didn't cooperate with the local communists. They would take a bunch of people and they would bury them alive to terrorize the others to support the communists. Yeah. Anybody know about that? I knew about that. Do you know what I said, by the way? I said on my radio show very early on, I knew more about North Vietnam than the average South Vietnamese. And it turns out it's exactly what he writes in this book, this British historian, who thinks the war, to the best of my knowledge, was a mistake. He has no axe to grind except, to the best of my knowledge, to tell the story as it has happened, as it happened. They were shocked at what the communists did when they got to South Vietnam. Look, there are a lot of South Koreans who want to make peace with North Korea, because they probably got as factually challenged an education about communism in South Korean schools as they do in American schools, which is mind-blowing, just mind-blowing. Why there aren't annual Thank You America parades in Seoul. One of the wealthiest countries in the world now, South Korea. You're probably using a Korean phone, and you may well be driving a Korean car and using a Korean screen to watch movies. This is all 100% because of American debts. 37,000 died to keep these people free. And then you got anti-American demonstrations. Everything I see in the world vindicates the Judeo-Christian worldview. Human nature is pretty rotten. It can be beautiful. That's the thing. There are beautiful people around. But human nature, it's really... I have a lot of questions for God. And I mean this quite sincerely. Aside from why did he invent the mosquito? I admit that's still number one. Number two, why'd you make human nature so flawed? How do you bury people alive and then have dinner? We'll be back.
The Dennis Prager Show, live.
The interview is in large measure, but not solely, about courage. Teachers of this country in many cities, lamentably cowardly. Afraid of dying of COVID from third graders. Staggering. And they say they follow the science. One of my favorite thinkers on Earth, I admit that outside of Earth there may be many finer thinkers, but on this planet is Michael Walsh. I mean, I know Michael so many years, but I blow names all the time. I'm always happy I got my wife's name right. Michael Walsh is an original mind. That's the highest compliment I give. And he is a moral thinker. And whenever he publishes a book, I have him on. His latest is Last Stand. It's up at DennisPrager.com. Why Men Fight When All Is Lost. Michael has written a number of books about the situation of the human condition, which is my favorite type of book. This one is a fascinating book, taking battle after battle, but it's really not just about war or battles, it's about life, where people, knowing that they would die, kept fighting. Michael, welcome to the Dennis Prager Show.
Dennis, it's great to be back with you. Thank you for having me on.
For my listeners' edification, where are you now living?
At the moment, I'm at my house in rural New England, where it's a crisp 20 degrees or so at the moment. We're heading into the coldest part of the winter, so pretty soon we'll be down below zero and snug as bugs in rugs up here.
And the rest of the time?
I spent most of last year at my home in Ireland, Dennis, on the west coast of Ireland, where I rebuilt my great-grandmother's birthplace in honor of her and of my family some years back, and that's where my family is now, as a matter of fact.
That's quite a life. That's why I wanted people to know that. Have you emotionally connected to Ireland?
Well, I think it's always part of every Irishman's upbringing, Irish-American upbringing. There's a recognition of our heritage and where we came from, the struggles we had to go through to come here. Dennis, as you know, the history of Ireland is one of 700 years of oppression by the English and then 100 years of dying on rickety coffin ships coming over to America to try to start a new life and contribute something to this country. So, yes, I'm very fond of it. I'm related to most of the people in my very rural area who are first and second cousins, and it's just a wonderful place to be. It's going through, unfortunately, the same thing the rest of the world is going through right now with COVID madness and immigration madness, but it's still good old Ireland as far as I'm concerned.
Has the left taken over much of life there like here?
Well, Ireland has a very unusual electoral system, which was, like most other horrible things, was imposed on us by the English. And the only other place that uses it is the island of Malta. So for those of you who are interested in exotic electoral systems, check out Ireland and Malta. But it effectively results in a one-party state. The two parties there, Fine Gael and Fianna Fáil, I won't bother to go into the etymology of the history, divided over the question of whether Ireland should sign the treaty that was negotiated after the revolution against England in the 1920s and 30s or not. And so that question is unfortunately still not settled because the British control six counties of the north. But it's forgotten by most people. So we have basically a uniparty system, and they dictate according to their whim.
But in general, like the schools in this country are essentially left-wing seminaries. Is that true there?
It's hard to say. The schools, until relatively recently, Ireland retained its Catholicism, but they've been busily demolishing that. So you are looking at the deinstitutionalization of a faith that kept the people together from the time that William the Conqueror and others landed, in this case Strongbow, the century after Hastings, and from the time of Cromwell, when the persecution was so bad that the people were dispossessed of their language, their land, they were herded into churches and burned alive, they were executed in particularly gruesome ways. So the church held the people together, but now it's being deinstitutionalized. Abortion has been made legal. Gay marriage, of course, has been made legal. And so it's on the run, and I don't see things changing much. There's a great push for immigration from the Third World, particularly Afghanistan, the Middle East, and Central Africa, because Ireland is considered too white. And there's even a program called Ireland 2040, which will change the ethnic makeup of the country irrevocably.
And I want to get to your book, obviously, but you're so interesting, and this is something that's new to most of my listeners. What is the rationale behind the notion that Ireland is too white? What is that? Let me put it to you this way. If I asked somebody there, is Nigeria too black? What would they say?
Yeah, well, that's a good question. The Irish are embarrassed. It's funny because, as you know, there's a left-wing historian named Noel Ignatieff, I think a Canadian, who wrote a book called How the Irish Became White, because they were never considered white, certainly not by the English, and barely by the Americans when we started coming here in really very large numbers in the mid-19th century. And so it's considered a kind of relic. People seriously ask questions, why are there no black faces in medieval Irish history? And getting to your point about courage and about teachers, I mean, you just have to wonder, where does that kind of stupidity come from? If you say it's just the way it evolved, then it becomes a plot and it's racism and we've got to overcome it. Ireland's in the grip of the left pretty solidly at this point. I mean, what do you say to a country that legalizes abortion, then turns around and says, we need more people to come in because our pension system will fail? so therefore we have to increase the population.
Well, that's that. Even putting abortion aside, you're entirely right, but that is the Achilles heel of socialism. Let's keep expanding the government, but somebody has to pay for the government. And if you don't have more young people, you got to bring them in.
Right. Well, that's Germany, for example, obviously. And that's, to a lesser extent, the United States. We are not in the worst possible situation here, unlike many of the European countries. It's interesting that Denmark...
I know. Go ahead. I know I was going to report that. Go ahead.
Am I stepping on your...
No. Are you kidding? It's a non-issue. Go ahead.
Denmark has said the ideal number of new immigrants is zero. So that's a pretty brave thing to say.
They went further. I mean, that the whole essence of being a Dane will be changed.
Yes, and that's considered a racist statement by the left.
Quintessence of racism.
Yes. But, you know, how do the Jewish people feel about that, Dennis? What if you were told you have to cast aside 5,000 years of Judaic history and become something that you're not? I mean, what has held the Jewish people together in the face of hostility, provocation, persecution, etc.?
Now, it is astonishing, isn't it? Of course you're right. Of course. I mean, even left-wing Israelis, or at least liberal Israelis, would think it preposterous. Let us have a plan, Israel 2040, because Israel is too Jewish.
Right. Yeah.
Right. It's beyond belief.
Now we wander into things that people aren't supposed to say or point out, and here we are back at courage again, aren't we, Dennis?
Courage is everything. And you know that. And the book is magnificent. By the way, I looked at the Amazon number. It's doing really well.
Oh, we were a huge hit. We sold out on day one. Day one, it was all copies were gone. So we had to scramble to get, 20,000-30,000 more copies in the pipeline over the Christmas break and with all the COVID slowdowns and everything. So we're doing very well, and that's thanks to people like you and my other friends on the conservative side of the aisle who have
Last Stands, Why Men Fight When All Is Lost. Coming up with the inimitable Michael Walsh. Original minds of our time, Michael Walsh. We share a lot. We really do, because it includes classical music. That's a big part of your background, isn't it?
It is. I was a classical music critic for 25 years, first in Rochester, New York, where I went to college. I attended the Eastman School of Music, one of the great American conservatories. Then in San Francisco for a few years, and then mostly at Time Magazine during the last of its great glory years, starting in 1981. And it was exhilarating, was fun, I loved it, I still love music, but I no longer write about it because I pretty much have said everything I had to say, and obviously I wanted to move on.
Yes, I'm suppressing the desire to talk to you about classical music because I want to talk to you about your book. The book, Last Stands, Why Men Fight When All Is Lost. So what are the lessons that you derived from this courage and the battle after battle that you describe?
Well, this book is framed, Dennis, to pick up just a thread of our previous conversation about Ireland, with my father's experiences in the Korean War, where he was a young first lieutenant in the Marine Corps in 1950, and was at the battle not only of the Incheon Landing in Seoul, but the famous Battle of the Chosin Reservoir, which was itself a last stand for the Marine Corps, one that they survived, and obviously he did too. I think it's never give up is really it. It's to engage the enemy as you are engaged. With last stands, they generally, they always come as a surprise to the team on the short end of the stick, and the Marines were surprised by the sudden attack of the Chinese communists in late November of 1950. Obviously, Custer was surprised by the size of the Indian village when he attacked it at the Little Bighorn, etc. But the most important lesson that I derived, and this came directly from my father, who is still alive, he's 94 now and living peacefully in Florida, was that you don't react in fear. The instinct that keeps you you alive is you, as he put it, you go to work. And that's how many soldiers will describe it. You follow your training. You don't panic. You don't break a line. When you break the line, you're dead, as the Romans discovered at the Teutoburg Forest, for example. You just put your head down. Battlefield deaths are whimsical. You can see why the Greeks believed in multiple gods. You have no idea whether you're going to get hit and killed by a lucky shot or you're going to survive a barrage. Grant, for example, at Shiloh was hit a couple of times. One of them hit his scabbard and sent his sword flying, but he was fine. Other men were killed instantly just as they approached the battle line. You don't know, so you can't care is the point, and you just go ahead and follow your training, because if you do that, you might survive. If you don't do that, you will die. And that's the simplest explanation of why men fight. There's others, of course, but that's how they live through these things.
The human tendency, which I personally try to guard against, is the belief that it was better in the past. It was better in the past about any or many given things. Certainly, not health-wise, but in many arenas. So even acknowledging that danger, would you say that there was more courage in past generations?
I would say there was more duty. Courage is a funny thing. You don't know you have it until it's tested, and even if it's tested, you still don't know you have it. You only know it in retrospect. You don't want the man in your unit, and I say man, not woman, for reasons we could possibly go into later. You don't want the guy who wants to die on the battlefield. You don't want the showboat, the show-off, the quarterback of the team. You want somebody who wants to live through this. But the notion is about courage is you do your duty, you do your job. And the other thing I would add to why men fight is you fight for the man next to you. If we go back to the Greeks and Romans, the Greeks in the phalanxes, the Romans in the maniples, the idea was that you defended the man to your right. That is, your sword hand was generally your right hand. And if it wasn't, they made it your right hand. And your shield was on your left. So the whole giant hedgehog assembly was designed to protect the man to your right. This left the guys on the edges, of course, in some trouble, so you protected your flanks with cavalry. But that was it. You fight for the guy next to you, and the guy next to you is fighting for you. And it's that simple.
You write about battle after battle, so I'll pose a challenging question here. Do they differ? And if they don't, why didn't you just write about one battle?
Do they differ?
Do they differ? Yes.
Yes, they do differ in many ways. I mean, in some of them, the men all get killed, and some of the men survive. They differ from historical epoch to historical epoch. However, in one sense, they are all the same battle. I think the Greeks, for example, who really kind of are the archetypal examples of this. On the third day of Thermopylae, most classical battles lasted for one day, and then they were decided, and that was it. But the Greeks put up a stand, led by the Spartans, but with other Greek city-states involved, at the hot gates, at this very narrow pass between the sea and the mountains. On the third day of the battle, the Persians sent spies to see what the Greeks were up to, and they were exercising and combing out their long hair. This is how they reacted to this massive army that was coming down the pike to exterminate them. And I think that insouciance, in a way, does mark, with battlefield humor, gallows humor, many of the conflicts that I outline in Last Stance.
I talked with my wife about these issues, and We were wondering the other day, if America were invaded, have we produced a generation that would fight? And when we come back, I'd like you to answer that. I almost find it incredible that either of us would even ask the question. Because I'm saying literally, if the Chinese invaded this country, just to throw out a possible, I mean, it's completely improbable, but have we raised a generation that would fight? Back in a moment.